Hi, it's good to have your company. You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Well, what does freedom of religion mean in a secular society? What role, if any, should religion be given in the public square? What kind of religion is thought of as acceptable these days in the West? Well, to answer these questions and more, and they're quite contested topics, my guest today is Dr. Ryan Messmore. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's good to have you in. I'll just mention your CV. Ryan is president-elect of Campion College, which is Australia's only tertiary liberal arts college, about to take up that appointment. And for the past 6 years, he's served at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. as a research fellow in religion and civil society. Ryan's a graduate of Duke University's Cambridge and Oxford, and so he's well qualified to talk about these topics. It's great to have you in. Now, freedom of religion, it's an important concept of Western liberal democracies, but you feel that only a certain type of religion is acceptable these days.
That's right. I think, you know, a lot of the conversation these days talks about whether religion has a place in the public square or not, as if it's kind of all or nothing. And a lot of people think that the debate is between should we have religion at all, or should all religion be scrubbed from the public square? My concern is that in the attempt to carve out some space for faith and faith groups in the public square, religious organizations themselves might actually be hindering their ability to act robustly in the public square by creating space only for a watered-down version of faith, what I would call it a privatized version of faith. So whereas we might look around and say, in modern democracies, we have freedom of religion. It's there in our government documents. Our politicians use the phrase. Actually, we may only be safeguarding space for watered down, irrelevant, privatized forms of religious expression, which is not a full, robust notion of religious liberty.
Well, let's come back to that in a moment, but I wonder whether you'd answer this question. Isn't it reasonable in a secular state for people to be expecting that religion sort of remains out of the public square? So for people who aren't believers, they might think, well, what role does religion have in this place anyway?
Well, to hold that sort of assumption, you already have to buy into a certain dualism, which is very prevalent in our culture today. It's a certain split, a certain way of thinking about the world, where you split the world into two domains, the public and the private. The public domain is the domain of the hard sciences, politics, economics, science. It's where things are known straightforward without bringing in values. It's kind of objective knowledge, and it's the safe place for debate in the public on these sorts of issues. The private realm, in contrast, is held to be the realm of values, opinions, beliefs. It's where the family and the church operate. It's where people debate about the good, the true, the beautiful, things like that. So when people hear religious language being used in public debates, they think that something has been smuggled in to a territory where it doesn't belong. What I would encourage people who think that way to do is to recognize how every single decision we make, every single argument that takes place in the public square stems from somebody's view of the world, from somebody's certain commitments and convictions, and that includes every single law that the government passes. So there's no such thing as a value-neutral government or a value-neutral law. Every single law in the public square is somebody's values, down to the local library fine. So the values are already there. Religious groups have every right to articulate their values, as does everybody else in the public square.
Ryan, I've heard you liken this idea of religion to building model aeroplanes. That's meant to be quiet, private, and trivial. Now, this is something you would sort of caution against, right? Because, as you said, all of those things, the beauty, truth, and goodness, those sorts of aspects of life are things that are going to impact public life in one way or another.
That's right. That quote that you mentioned actually comes from a description of what happens to faith when it becomes privatized. It comes to be assumed as something only having to do with kind of spiritual ideas, thoughts about the afterlife, feelings of anxiety and guilt over, you know, personal sin, things like that. And so what religion comes to to refer to in that sense are these kind of, you know, spiritualized insides and insights, the feelings and ideas and emotions, which is fine. And as long as, you know, people operate in the privacy of their own homes, then that's fine. But what that ignores is an entire dimension of faith, of lived faith, of the social realities of faith, where we put our faith into action, where we are called as religious adherents to treat people a certain way and to work for the common good, to organize and structure our lives along a certain dimension. And that freedom is denied if that sort of public social lived reality, if that dimension of faith is suppressed and only the hymns and the counseling sessions are allowed to count as religion.
Yes. Is it the case then that in some ways this dynamic that you've identified is partly the fault of religious adherents themselves? They've managed to kind of put their faith into a private realm in a way that perhaps in previous eras wasn't the case.
That's right. I think it's a complex phenomenon. I think there are different influences going both ways. I think that governments and modern day societies have taken actions, have implemented policies which have pushed religion to the corner. But I also think that a theological mistake has been made in many churches over the past century, where the church has given in to that sort of understanding, where what the church is about getting to heaven after you die, and so yes, there is blame to be passed around in a lot of institutions, but Christians who want to advocate for robust religious liberty needs to look at their own understanding first, and the church needs to look at itself first and say, what, you know, are we contributing to this privatized understanding of what religion is all about?
Now, you, as someone who advocates a space for religion in the public realm, you obviously think that religion, let's say Christianity, has had a positive impact for the common good, as you described it. What has been that impact?
Well, if you look at all of the, I'm from the United States, if you look at all of the large movements in the States over the past 100, 200 years, the abolition of slavery, reform of prisons, starting hospitals for the sick, starting schools to help children become literate. All of those sorts of initiatives in the United States were started and pioneered by religious groups. I mean, there's a reason that most of the hospitals, the old hospitals in the United States, are called, St. Jude or St. Luke or St. Mary, because they were started by religious organizations. And so these are groups of people who are caring for people in need out of the motivation of their faith, of their deeply held commitment to their Christian principles. And there needs to, it's in the best interest of society to allow groups who can serve the common good to do that freely. It doesn't mean that society should allow groups to do anything they want in the name of religion. Religious freedom is not a free-for-all. There are certain boundaries within which groups have to work. They have to uphold the rule of law. They have to be nonviolent. They have to support public morality and public health and public order and that sort of thing. But within that space, Christians, the Christian church has over time been able to contribute in numerous ways to the common good.
You're identifying some of these movements in a very positive direction, and your sense is that as it gets more and more watered down and more privatized, it's less effective in doing those things, right? But what about then, do you speak as robustly on behalf of other religions other than the Christian religion?
Yes, absolutely. The religious liberty needs to be extended to every group and safeguarded for every group who is willing to work within those boundaries that I described. That includes explicit religious groups that call themselves religious, the church of such and such, and it includes other groups. It includes groups that want to help people, perhaps not out of something that they would name as a religious motivation, but because they're moved to do so. Something deep inside them causes them to want to help those groups as well. People who don't claim to have any religion at all need to be free to make their arguments in the public square and start their organizations and to run those organizations on their principles, as long as they can do so, again, within that broader social context of adhering to the rule of law and upholding the common good.
So is your sense that this movement is something that should concern not just believers, but secular people as well?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think all citizens need to be fervent advocates for liberty, liberty properly understood, and that liberty needs to extend to all sorts of different groups. And in a pluralist society, that's going to benefit. We're going to get different perspectives, different approaches. Groups that might think differently than our group will come up with a way to solve a problem. And we can look and see, what did they do? How did it work? How might we be able to incorporate some of those lessons into the way we do? And so if you have a pluralistic society with a diverse number of groups all contributing to the public square, talking with each other, allowing each other the freedom to do things according to the way they see fit, then we have a flourishing community, a flourishing society.
Now, you've identified some threats to this freedom of religion, and you've recently spoke about concerns that religious people might have freedom to profess their faith, but not really govern their institutions or businesses according to faith. Now, I reckon some people will be a bit alarmed at that language, and it might concern people, especially people who aren't believers.
Right. And I can understand that concern. I mean, you look around and you see groups that are wanting to implement the laws of their own group on the rest of society. And you think about efforts to usher in Sharia law and things like that. This is immediately what comes to people's minds. And again, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not advocating a free-for-all. I'm advocating a proper role of government to create a safe space within society where people's rights are protected, where the rights of groups are protected, to engage in civil discourse, civil debate, and allow all groups, all people, to have a place at the table and to try to persuade each other. Here's how we can contribute to the common good. We need to be free to do that. But you're right, that's a much more robust picture of religious freedom in a free society than simply the freedom of worship, which is kind of the tagline in the United States that is coming to name this more watered-down freedom, the freedom to profess faith, the freedom to go to church where you want, but not the freedom for religious groups to be able to hire and fire the people they want, to distribute the employee benefits that they want, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, you can see when people get concerned, though, and they feel like there's discrimination by religious groups in things like employment and that sort of thing. How do you respond to that sort of criticism?
Every institution that hires people wants to hire people who will serve their mission, who identifies with the values of that group. The Democratic Party in the United States should be able to hire only Democrats. Republican groups should be able to hire only Republicans. The environmental groups, PETA, should be able to hire people who resonate with the vision of that organization. All I'm asking for is that religious organizations be able to have that same freedom in a democracy, to be able to say to an employer, look, do you want to enter a voluntary relationship with us? Here's what we are. Here's what we stand for. We think that you could help us. Would be willing to pay you a certain salary and certain benefits. Let's enter in an agreement. And as long as both parties are agree to that, then the group, religious group, should be free to operate out of their values and principles, just like every other institution in civil society.
Well, finally, you're someone who would emphasize freedom as vital, but ironically, might not an overemphasis on individual freedom be part of the problem that you've identified?
That's right, and that's why I point back to the difference between liberty and freedom. Freedom today is often understood in an individualist context. It's often understood to be a license, just do whatever you want regardless.
Endless choice.
Right, choice, autonomy. Liberty is something deeper. It has to do with truth, the truth of human nature, the truth of human flourishing. And it has to do with the ability to exercise self-government in line with who we are as human beings. So freedom, liberty is never the ultimate goal. It's always something that serves the end of human flourishing. But you have to have a concept of that, and you have to be able to debate that in public in order for freedom to serve the end that it's meant to serve.
Well, this is a topic that's going to go on being of one of interest, religion in the public square. Dr. Ryan Messmore, it's great to get your thoughts on that. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.